Welcome to the EDUCAUSE podcast. This podcast features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference. You can find more podcasts like this by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts or subscribe to our iTunes feed by searching for EDUCAUSE. This podcast is sponsored by Real Networks and features a session from the EDUCAUSE 2008 annual conference. Participants include Gerald D. Hinkle, Executive Director of Computer Services at Temple University, Jeremy Schaefer, Director of Information Technology and Computer Services at Temple University, and Sherry Stoller, Associate Vice President of Computer Services at Temple University. The session is entitled Conflicting Priorities and Constrained Resources, the Soft Side of Application Development Project Management in a Nonprofit Environment.
Our speakers this morning, again from Temple University, we have Jerry Hinkle, who's the Executive Director of Computer Services. He's going to be talking with you first this morning. Jeremy Schaefer is a Director of Information Technology and Computer Services. He's going to be speaking with you second. And then lastly, we have Sherry Stoller. Sherry's going to be talking to us last. She's the Vice President, Assistant Vice President of Computer Services. So with that, I will turn the program over to you guys.
Thank you, Bill. And as you can see, our title is The Soft Side of Application Development and Project Management in a Nonprofit Setting. So if you're coming to look for Gantt charts or Microsoft Project or Primavera or whatever, can go down the hall, because we're focusing in on the people skills and how to manage expectations of your users, how to listen to them, and what people skills are necessary in a project management setting, particularly a nonprofit setting. A few facts about Temple. You already know we're located in Philadelphia, although we do have international campuses in Japan and Rome. We have about 35,000 students, 24,000 of whom are on our main campus. Our computer services organization, we have a centrally run computer services organization with about 250 people. And the group we're focusing in on today is Jeremy's group, which is solutions development. And they do web-based application development and database work. They don't do major administrative systems, ERP systems. That's another group. What they do is smaller academically oriented projects. Typical examples might be a Get Connected program for students who are bringing their computers into the dorm. We've got what we call a University Disciplinary Committee application that allows students who get in trouble to kind of work their way through almost a TurboTax environment where they can get advice, kind of legal advice, before they go for their hearings. And a number of other programs, commencement tickets, all kinds of stuff. So that gives you an idea of what we're doing. And now let's look at the statement of the problem. Now, before I start, how many of you do application development in the room or oversee it? Okay, a lot of you. How many of you charge for that service? And how many of you do it for free? Okay, I thought so. And you're probably familiar with the situation we have here. First of all, you provide a service, software development. It's free, and I put free in quotes because obviously there's still a background cost. Everybody wants it. Everybody wants it all. And everybody wants it all now. Most of this starts with a very typical situation here. How many of you have heard this? Splendid. You can help me with a little small project. It shouldn't take too much time. And oh, by the way, we do have a bit of a deadline. We talk about, people look at us funny, but we talk about elevators and elves here. The elevator encounter. How many of you have been in a situation where you say, get on an elevator, and a potential client comes in, and they say to you, hey, would it be possible to do something? I have a bunch of paper forms. I want to have them electronically put up there so people can fill them out. And maybe you, or maybe more importantly, one of your programmers says, yeah, that's possible to do. And they get off the elevator thinking they've just answered a theoretical question. Yeah, yes, it's technology, anything's possible. The client, of course, gets off and thinks that someone has just agreed to do a project for them. And in many cases, they think that project has already started. And coming into Halloween today, and maybe the Christmas season brings in our elves and our gnomes. In there, for example, if my son asks for a Nintendo Wii for Christmas, I write it down on my list, and in my mind, it's just on the list. In his mind, you know, the elves are busy at the Nintendo workshop at the North Pole building this Wii already. And in a lot of cases, our clients think the same way, not necessarily elves, but they do think that they put in a request, and somehow magically there's elven programmers back in the offices already working on it. And this leads to elevated expectations. People think the project's already being worked on, so when they get to the point where they meet with you, they somehow expect it to already be done. But here's what needs to happen and what we're going to be talking about today. We need a more standardized system of putting in requests, not just the elevator encounter, but something a little bit more formal. We need to find out how we can talk to our clients to establish their needs and expectations, have regular checkpoints after that point once the project begins to control those expectations, define an actual endpoint. How many of you have the project that never ends? Or I should ask, how many of you have a project? Probably none of you have a project that don't end. They all seem to go on forever. And also, obviously, we've got a plan for maintenance even after the project is done. And these just some of the questions that we'll be looking at today. How does this casual inquiry become a project? How can you really grasp your client's needs and expectations? And how do you explain the cost, time, scope of the project to your client? And looking at the forest instead of the trees, we don't just deal with individual projects, we deal with whole portfolios. Okay, some of the challenges. You've probably heard of the trifold constraint. We've got money, we've got time, and we've got complexity. And that leads us to this triangle many of you may have seen, you know, with cost, time, and complexity. You know, you can have something fast, but it's going to cost you. You can have something more complex, but it may take more time and more money. You can have something cheaper, but it may be have to be smaller in scope. Now, our problem here is that in our model, this whole thing gets thrown out of scope because we have a two-sided triangle. We have time, we have complexity, but we don't necessarily have cost as that controlling factor. Another factor we kind of enter into is the meeting of the unlike minds. Very often, our programmers and probably our clients assume that everybody thinks just like me. You know, if a programmer is meeting with somebody from the admissions office, you know, the assumption is, they work the same way as me. They understand what priorities I have. They understand how busy I am. And the admissions person is meeting with them thinking, hey, we recruit new students. They know how important we are. They know how important admissions is to the whole university. And you really have to have a meeting of the minds in those areas. Another problem is a client understanding the product. Now, let's say you want to order something like a shoe. You go to a store, you say, hey, I want a loafer, I want it black, I want a leather sole, rubber heels, and I want this little doohickey that I can stick a penny in if I'm into that kind of thing. That's very clear. It's a tangible object. The problem with programming is that tangibility goes out the window, and you then have the elves coming in. To the user, hey, they have something with just two screens, you know? That's all they see up front. They don't realize the hours and the times that go into it.
I'm the prop person, sorry.
Yeah. They, you know, in the physical world, you ask for a loafer, you don't get a heel. At least we hope you don't. In the intangible world of software development, you very often get what you don't ask for. So it's really important to communicate with your client. Okay, with that, I'll turn it over to Jeremy, and we'll take a walk on the soft side.
Working with my not-quite-wireless microphone. So, again, taking a walk on the soft side, and what we're going to be looking at is the way projects are executed at Temple University, and that's going to look different at your institution. I know that it will. But whatever your methodology, whatever your best practices are, I guarantee you that there is a set of soft skills, interpersonal skills, that are very valuable for the IT manager and for the IT staff themselves, the ones who are actually executing the project. And the reason they're so valuable is because they're required to successfully manage the expectations of your client and nurture a relationship with them so that you can prevent yourself from getting into an adversarial relationship and really work on understanding each other's expectations and assumptions, because those are on both sides of that conversation. Oh, and I need my pointer here. So the whole project starts with the initial inquiry phase. This is something of a necessary evil. It's the most frustrating part of the project for me, because at this stage, the critical pieces of information you need to manage the project don't exist. You don't know, or you may not know, who all the stakeholders are. You may not know what the critical success factors are. You may not even know what the real deadline is. All you really know for sure is that there's a lot of conversations going on about something. And somehow you have to be able to transition from all that conversation and noise into an actual formal request. So the skills you need to be able to develop in yourself is the ability to have that sort of elevator conversation and then bring the client along to the point of making that formal request. And I do that by preparing a certain party line in my mind that goes along the lines of, wow, that project you're describing is very interesting, and I can see how it could really benefit the university. Your next best step is, and then you complete the sentence with what your formal request mechanism is. It's important for you to do that not just as an individual, but to give that party line to your whole staff, because you know there's going to be a time when somebody makes that request and you won't be there to intervene. And it helps to have that wording already in your head, even go so far as to craft an email template if the request comes via email. Once you get the client to actually place a formal request into the formal request mechanism, and here at Temple, we have a web form. We call it tuhelp.temple.edu. We direct people to go there, fill out a form. The request makes the request for service, the request for further discussion, official. And what it really does is it lets you know who is making the request, when they made it, and the user has an opportunity to put the request into their own words. And this really is an opportunity for you to demonstrate some good service to your customers. You can say, all right, when a request comes in through this channel, I commit to following up within 48 hours with some sort of conversation where we will arrange an initial meeting. And we plan to have that initial meeting happen sometime in the next 2 weeks. Your challenge at that phase is, again, to set the expectation that in that first meeting, we won't be presenting you with a solution. We'll be talking about what it is we need to really complete the project. And up here, we have just a quick screenshot of the main form and that TU Help application. I'm not going to dwell on that. The point of this is simply that all the pieces of information you need to manage the project, they're not here. All this is making the request official, and it's letting us know who made the request, when they made it, and it's an opportunity for the user to put the request in their own words and to indicate who they talk to. It's also a mechanism for the client to come back at a later date, which is one of the benefits of this particular approach, and they can see an update on their project. Okay, so you come into that initial meeting, and that's the beginning of the kickoff phase of the project, where you're determining the client's actual needs. This is a great opportunity for you to get the customer at the table and the member of your IT staff who is most likely going to be assigned to the project, get them in the same room, let the customer express their requirements verbally so the IT person and yourself get the full benefit of the whole communication package, all the nonverbals, everything. It's an opportunity for you to sit, listen empathetically, communicate clearly, and the key outcome is you want to come up with some written summary of what the critical success factors, the goals of the project are, because you're going to need that written summary later on. And it's your opportunity to define a next step. And sometimes the next step is a quick fix that can kind of take the pressure off the client, and immediately you've built a relationship with the client there, and that you can build on that later on, and they might be open to a more well thought out, more elaborate solution that might take a little bit longer. It's important in that conversation that the client understand what they're getting themselves into. People come at the world of development with two understandings. One is based on a waterfall metaphor, and the other one is based on an agile development approach or a spiral metaphor. I'm not going to, in the waterfall metaphor, the names of these phases, they change from methodology to methodology. But the idea of the waterfall metaphor is at the start of the project, you're at the top of the waterfall, you're developing all, determining all the requirements, and you, with perfect clarity, envision the end result and all the requirements, and then you progress through development and testing, and then you get down to the end, and you deliver the final result, and you're done. You can manage IT projects that way, but what you're really expecting the client and your team to do is to do that envisioning stage perfectly and accurately. And some people who are highly analytical can do that, but not everybody can. Very smart, intelligent, gifted people in other disciplines cannot envision all of the ramifications of technical decisions early on in the project. So from there, we move on to a spiral metaphor, right, where the key idea is we're going to talk to you, we're going to gather some preliminary requirements, we're going to develop a prototype, and then we're going to come back and we're going to show it to you. And then we're going to get your reaction. And then we're going to go away and we're going to refine that prototype a little bit more. And this is a great approach for projects that are rooted in information technology because you don't have the benefit of that tangible physical shoe to refer to, right? Of course, there's a threat here too because the spiral can keep on going and going and going. So how do you manage that spiral? Well, one way is to convey the value of what you do. We don't have the cost constraint on that side of the triangle. The requests keep coming in. And it's a challenge for IT management to convey the cost of what they do. And the message you want to convey is, my service may be perceived as free to you, but it is not cheap. It does come at a cost. And again, I talked about things that you want to have in your vocabulary, little party lines that you want to have memorized. So if you come into that initial meeting and you are able to say, you know, I have 12 active projects right now, and I have three more that I anticipate starting next month. Two of them are for the president's office, and one of them will affect every student on campus. I understand that what you're asking for is very important, but let's see how we can fit in your needs with the context that I'm trying to work with. Immediately, the client understands that you are juggling, right? And you need, again, those interpersonal skills in that setting. Right? You can't deliver that message and be blunt or crude about it. You need to be able to say, this is what I'm working with, this is who I'm doing it for, and this is the scope of the projects that I'm working on. I need you to understand that. Personal note, for years and years and years of my life, I was under the impression that I had to convey to every client, every customer of mine, that they were my number one priority. And it all came from a bit of advice that I got fresh out of college from a guy named Jack, who gave me what then sounded like really good advice. He came from the world of consulting, where you worked off the billable hour, and he said, never tell your client that you've got a list and that you're number five on the list. Always tell them that they're number one. Immediately, that builds expectations that are unrealistic. And because we don't have the constraint of the billable hour, it's imperative that we convey what we're really dealing with. Another mechanism for creating value is to compare yourself with outside contractors. So you have that little speech memorized where you talk about what your workload is, and then you say, you know, I anticipate that I'll be able to start your project in roughly 6 months. However, I'm aware of a consulting agency who could probably take it on, and they might be able to accomplish it in roughly 2 months at a cost of $25,000. Immediately, the client understands the value of the work you do. It has commercial value in comparison with that outside entity. And it also is an opportunity for them to make a decision. The ball is back in their court. Do I wait or do I try to find those funds? If you choose to go down that road, and I know people have different sensibilities in this area. Some feel like it's not appropriate for me to refer somebody outside for whatever reason, be it security or what have you. If you just choose to go down that road, it's important that you commit to serving a sort of broker role between your internal client and that external service provider. Otherwise, what's very likely to happen is that you will step out of the middle and there will be requirements gathering going on and there will be development going on, and it's very likely that there will be some miscommunication there for the reasons we've already talked about. And that the client will end up with a woman's high heel shoe when what they asked for was a black loafer. So, checkpoints. It's not enough to rely on that initial meeting. If you're relying only on the initial meeting to gather requirements, you're back in the waterfall metaphor again. So what we do when we have a project that needs to be driven to completion, it has a very fixed deadline, we have regular scheduled checkpoints that are focused. It's an opportunity to present prototypes, and it's a forum for the client and at least one of the developers actually working on the project to have communication with each other. It's a great opportunity for you as a manager to understand what's really going on in the project in terms of not just the success or failure of the technical details, but what's going on interpersonally. And it's also a great opportunity for you to mentor your IT staff. If you were to work with me for any period of time, you'd hear me say, I never went into IT because I loved people, right? You know, what draws people into, let's say, a computer science major, right? It's because we like technology, we like to fix things, we like to build things, and yet you need to nurture those abilities in yourself and in your staff, and chances are they were drawn into the IT profession not because they loved people, right? They might have gone into marketing or advertising if they were of that mindset. So you need to nurture those things, and you can, in the context of those meetings, there's some good mentoring that can go on. All right, so at the outset, you put your project requirements in writing, your critical success factors. That was in the project summary after the very initial meeting. Now, as the checkpoints progress, you recognize that, hey, this prototype is approaching those requirements. You need to start communicating to the customer that we need to draw this to completion. And that's another stage where expectation setting is really key, because you need to be able to say, all right, if you've done a good job, chances are the client is delighted with your service and is starting to ask for new things. Right? And they may be asking for a whole other project. And that's your opportunity to diplomatically say, this is the summary we did. This is the prototype we've developed. These requirements match. We need to bring this project to resolution before we can consider that additional next step. And you know what the next step is. It's the formal request process. So again, you're not saying no to the customer. You're not creating an adversarial relationship. But what you are doing is you're showing that you're bringing the project to resolution. In addition to those verbal conversations where you say, we're considering this project complete because we've met the requirements, in addition to those verbal conversations, you want to follow that up with written communication. You know, writing each and every one yourself is fine. It's nice to supplement that with some sort of automated completion message that's just standard. And in addition to all those things, if you're still wrestling with how do I really convey to all these people how this project is complete, one thing that we've done at Temple is very, I think, unusual, but it seems to be effective, is we have actually, in some cases, we've actually had a party. An interesting idea, you get a cake, your picture of the web application or the website on the cake. You get people in, the cake is cut, and there's a recognition that something changed here. Something went live, something was brought to completion. It's a memorable event. We don't do it for every event, but it's a nice way of doing that sort of closure. And then, of course, maintenance, right? That's the thing that's overlooked in most IT projects. You know, we're innovative people. We like to create new things, right? So the maintenance phase is very easy to overlook. We like to anticipate that after the initial flurry of activity after a product launch, right, this, which is usually exceptional amount of maintenance going on and minor, you know, tweaking, you want to anticipate that the lead developer or one of your staff is going to probably have to allocate 3% of their time over the coming year to maintaining that project. So every new project you bring in, you have to be prepared to allocate a little bit of time to that task. You want to keep that percentage as low as you can. And some things you can do to keep that percentage down is, number one, give the end user the facility to provide some content. So as their processes change, if they need to change wording or something on one portion of the application, they can. And that means that you invest in the time and or tools necessary to do that. It also has to do with the quality of your code. One of my mantras that I keep telling my staff is never write code that only you can maintain. Never write code that only you can maintain. I say it over and over and over and over again. Because as years go by, at some point, that project is either going to need to be refreshed, retired, rewritten, or sometimes reassigned. It may actually go off to another developer somewhere else in the university, or even out to a third party. And you don't want to get yourself into the position where we say, I have to rewrite it in order to give it away. The name of my group is Solutions Development, and I want to continue developing new things. I don't want to be Solutions Maintenance. Maintenance is important, and we do it. Everyone should perform some maintenance tasks for the things they're responsible for. But I want to create an environment where the new applications can continue to flow through my team. It's also important to remember that you, in committing to a project, you may commit to some sort of seasonal factor. If I do something like dorm move-in or... I'm sorry.
Can I ask a question about 3% rule?
Sure.
Is that 3% of the time you put into the project or 3% of the developer's...
3% of the developer's time. And it is not a written in stone rule. But we're figuring, maybe an hour a week over the course of a year comes out to roughly 3% of a 40-hour work week, give or take.
So that has a fixed kind of timeline?
Yeah. It's really a rule of thumb. It's like the 80-20 rule, right? So we've looked at what application development looks like at Temple, and I'm sure there's differences and nuances at your institution, but throughout that whole process, communication with the client is really key. Having those face-to-face checkpoints or, at a bare minimum, phone calls are incredibly important so that you can get the requirements as they go. And creating that summary of work at the very beginning so you can refer back to it at the end. And communication happens over and over and over again throughout the life of the project. And I think the biggest thing to just train yourself and your staff to do is to say, the communication burden cannot be solely on the IT manager. I need to be able to train my IT staff and coach them in the skills they need to collaborate with other members of the university. And so that communication burden is not all on one person, it's distributed throughout. So I've been talking about managing an individual IT project. Sherry's going to come and talk about managing a whole portfolio, which is a whole other animal.
I have to use the wireless mic.
There's an awful lot of wires for a wireless mic.
It'll be back to back. I speak pretty loudly, so with the mic or without, just let me know.
Okay, I just want to ask a question. First of all, this is all this gardening analogy, and if people really knew me, they would know that I'm not the best at gardening, especially if you saw what my vegetable garden this year. But how many of you have managed projects that have failed? That's why they brought me here. Because if anything can go wrong, I've done it or experienced it. So hopefully you learn and you move on and you learn and you move on. But I've been there. I know. And as Jerry mentioned about, you know, if you have something for free. In fact, I said, Jerry, would you mind? He was going to run for some refreshments. I said, would you mind getting some coffee for me? And it was the refreshment break. And he came back and he goes, the line is so long you wouldn't believe. And I said, why not? It's free, right? Unlimited demand. So, of course, I had to go and pay for the coffee. So the key is, if you have projects, then you group them together and you have your portfolio. Okay, easier said than done. What, first of all, and something I want to emphasize, this is where it's all different. You have to define what your project is. Every institution, every department, it's going to be different. So for us, we have to define what constitutes a project. We also have to define our services, and that constitutes our portfolio. And so even though I usually stay away from some terms, we are very much into the service catalog model, which is defined. And by the way, don't think that I've done this. When we do question and answer, I'm going to be asking you a lot of questions as well, because we are in the process of doing this. We have a service desk, so we can track our incidents. But right now, we're in the process of doing a service catalog so that we can define what services do we offer. And that means, when I say we, it could be my individual unit. It could be my unit as part of computer services, including administrative, telecommunications, and so forth. But you have to define. Otherwise, you can't manage. And you'll see I'll be going, you know, all over the place here with some of my content. But who is your client? And this is something where I think, I know I've made that mistake a lot. Your client is not just the person or group asking for the request or the project to be done. In fact, they are a small part. And the things that I have learned by trial and error, you have to manage not just your, quote, client asking for the request, but you have to manage, of course, your team or your teammates. You have to manage your peers, because resources are limited and you may need their resources. You certainly have to manage your superiors, and if that's your CIO or VP, you have to manage their priorities as well, and the priorities of the entire institution or unit. So I don't care what tools you have. How many of you have project management offices set up? That is great, because that is a wonderful outcome. But if you don't have your process or processes defined, what good is a process management office? So you have to define how or what is a project, your portfolio, your services, and how you're going to process everything. And it's terrific if you can have the facility, the funding to set up that project management office, but it's not critical to proceed. And that's what I want to let you know. At Temple, we do not have that funding yet. We're working on that, but it doesn't matter. That doesn't mean we say, oh, gee, we can't do this because we don't have the resources to manage. You do, just define your process. So, traditional, I think it's great to have the tools. I know that I've heard some people use Basecamp, some people use, we're using Remedy, which is incident tracking, and then overlaying that with our service catalog, which can be any vendor. It doesn't matter. It doesn't really matter. as I mentioned, this is an art, by the way. How many of you have service catalogs? Okay, I definitely want to hear from you. Was it easy to define? If you know what I'm talking about is, how many of your clients know to say, oh, I need to request, I have a new employee, so let me request an IP address. Oh, wait, now I need to have someone come out, put the drop, make sure the drop is there, make sure it's active. Oh, I need to order the equipment. Yeah, now when it comes in, I need to make sure I get someone in to set it up and then, you know, configure me to the network. Do you think our clients understand all that? So that's the incident tracking. The service catalog says, I have a new employee. Give them a PC. That's the difference. So what's key is you have to make sure that your services are in a language that your clients, be that your students, faculty, staff, alum, applicants, that they understand. And it's a real art. It's not easy to define. You'll go through different processes, but it will help you define your portfolio and then everything that falls within. Jerry, go back one, would you? This is what we found is critical. Now, Jeremy showed you our TU Help, which is really a Band-Aid approach on top of our service desk system, which is that Remedy BMC system. But what's important that we found is that now I have about five different departments. There's Jeremy's, desktop or desk side support. We have we run email, the web. We also smart classrooms. And guess what? Guess how many different input methods I had? As many units as I just mentioned, I had that many different types of input vehicles, and it could range. In my own help desk, the help desk had walk in, which is fine. Email, call someone and have a casual conversation. And I had no way of tracking everything. So we mandated, it may not be pretty, it may not be elegant, but it gets the person who's making the request thinking about it and entering it into one place. And that's key. And the key thing is allow them to track it. We call it the FedEx model. But if you allow your clients to see the status, how many of you get calls? God knows I still do. So-and-so promised me this, and I'm looking for the request, and it's some sort of black hole, bottomless pit. And you're thinking, oh, God, now what do I say? Because I have no idea what this request is or when. And they'll always say, I asked for this about 6 months ago. And, of course, you have no way of tracking it. So we do the FedEx model. We allow their clients to escalate, to put in comments, to say, hey, you know what, I solved the problem myself, or, hey, what's going on here? And that is really important. So think about that as a request or a project. Same with a portfolio. Because let's just take the provost office. And they have numerous departments that can submit requests. And we don't say to a person, hey, you know what, don't call so-and-so. You can take your traditional method of calling your favorite consultant, but make sure you submit because this will protect you and allow you to track everything. So the question that, you know, well, the problem is that with the portfolio, if you have a provost office and you have all these different units submitting requests, we just had a meeting last week, the provost office had no idea that there were so many requests out there. Now, if you're managing ERP systems, that's more formalized anyway, and it's been. So I can tell you that is a nice model to follow. But the problem is, what about the provost office asking for something with commencement? I was at a poster session yesterday. I saw University of Phoenix with their commencement process. What if we're running out, this group is doing email. So what if the provost office is involved with the email initiative or identity management, which we just ran out or implemented? So the key is there's a whole bunch of things out there that your constituents are not aware of. So here, this is where you can say, limited resources, here's our priorities, here's your portfolio, let's decide on priorities, and let them be the ones to decide. And what is our role as IT? It used to be that we were the ones, and you know, I don't know about this, but the old analogy when the web first started, and God knows I started in IT way before that, but when the web first started, how many of you would get requests from individual small offices to do a web page? And we did them. You know, if the English department wanted a website, yeah, no problem. If math wanted a website, no problem. And then what happened is it became that communication vehicle, and now you would say, hey, you know what? What does your school or college, how does it fit within that umbrella? So no longer do we accept individual requests, or when we do, we'll say, let's see how it fits in with your school or college priorities or whole umbrella. And that's what's critical. So our role is to inform and advise. Not to say you're first, you're second, you're third, you're fourth. That's not our role, all right? That's not the role that I want to be in. Now, here's the other thing that, as I said, I've made. If there's a mistake to be made, I made it. I can run a project, let's say, if I have a project team, great group, working, constantly communicating. And by the way, team dynamics, critical. You can't have, and this is something that I have found, you can't have a team member going off on their own. You can't have a team member bad-mouthing. Many of you have had that one, bad-mouthing the project to someone else on the side, even to your client. You need to have those constant checkpoints and make sure, but you also have to be able to market or showcase what you've done and how it fits in with your overall university goals and initiatives. You really have to communicate. And the mistakes that I've made and I've seen others make, they have not communicated to all of the people or the clientele. And I said, those are your team, your peers, your superiors, your other units. You need to say, here is what our services are, here are the projects as they fit in, and here's what we are doing, and you have to quantify. So, how does your portfolio grow? I just want to mention here, and actually I have some these are some of the gotchas, but let me just tell you some of the other ones. So besides not a failure to define your projects, your services, and so forth, how many of you had this one? You have a project that actually falls within two units that are requesting it. Or you have a project that falls within multiple units that have to deliver. Obviously, we all do, right? But if you don't have one person accountable, what happens? No one takes responsibility. And boy, have I seen that happen, then deadlines slip, and no one takes ownership, and there's a lot of finger pointing. So you got to watch out for that one. Even though the project manager is critical, you need that person to take ownership or that unit. Also, tools are great. The project management office is great. Make sure you define your process. One entry point, as I mentioned, one point in. That doesn't mean it's like accounting, which is first in, first out, or whatever that whole, you know, principle is. It means that you can see, and how many of you have had this one? I get a request in, I'm working on the project, or someone in my group is, only to find out that another unit has been working on the same project. Yeah, it's, how many of you had that one? I've had that one. Wow, I'm surprised. That's great if all of you have not, because it's, and I'm talking about within the computer services unit. The right hand and left hand are not always communicating. And there's that gray area. The other thing is change management. When we prototype, and that's, by the way, very key to success. We just rolled out identity management, and try telling your constituents that you're fixing the plumbing. I mean, what do they understand? But they do understand what changing passwords, the screens, the process. So prototype, prototype, prototype. I don't care how basic. And keep repeating it, because A lot of times we're in a meeting and we'll say, oh, yeah, we've showed you that already. Well, guess what? People don't remember that. We're immersed in it. But people coming to meetings and our clients, they're not going to remember. Keep emphasizing it. And if you do have a change, which will happen, make sure there's a change management process. Because all of a sudden there's a change and no one can remember who made it, who requested it, and why the heck do we do this? And now it's IT's fault that the project's off target. I've had that happen too. The other thing is the assessment. This is where Jeremy's talking about maintenance. What I'm talking about is when a project is done, you do a post-mortem. And I have to say that that's the part that I tend to gloss over too. Because you, thank you. Oh, that was Jerry. I thought he was going to yank the cord. Anyway, the post-mortem is critical because what you do well, what you didn't do well, and how many of you have that problem where estimating what certain tasks will take? So when you do a post-mortem, you can say, hey, you know what? Their estimate was really off on that. The next time, we'll get better estimates. And that works for project and portfolio management. Okay? And the other one is executive commitment. This is not going to work if you don't have the commitment from above. And I can guarantee that. You need, it's critical. And how many of you who do have those project management offices, how many of you, it was the CIO that initiated it? I just want to see. How many of you was more grassroots? I mean, is that, that's great. Because how do you get the resources to formalize it? You need the CIO or VP or whatever unit you report to acknowledge we need to manage our services and identify them and prioritize them, especially now. You know, Temple's state related. We've had our budget, I don't even want to tell you, we had our budget cut a lot. So it's now critical as to what we can deliver. I'm not allowed to hire anymore. My positions are frozen. I have to be pretty smart, and all of us, about our resources. So with all of that, let's see. No, I think that's pretty much it. Do you have any questions? Yeah.
How do you differentiate? A problem that we face a lot is the users don't understand what is a request for a new project and what simply requests.
Let me repeat that because that's an excellent question, and we have that same problem. When does something become a project? When does something that is an existing project, is it maintenance? How do you differentiate? How do you tie the two together? Let's say that you have a help desk request, and these are definitions that your unit has to work on, but one thing that we realized is that funnel in, that one funnel in is critical. Because that's how you can decide. And right now, it's our help desk office that gets that in and not prioritizes, but disseminates. And even so, I have to look at it. I have to have my immediate reports looking at the whole portfolio and the requests coming in. But you also, and we found out in our tracking system, we have to make sure we track and tie it together as well. It's. I still don't have the best answer for that. And if anybody does, I'd be interested in hearing it. Yeah.
Real quick, we're out of time.
Oh, gosh.
So if there are other, if
I'm
there,
the one who used up
if,
all your time.
If there's other questions, please come up and ask your questions.
Oh,
but
that,
so.
Yeah, that's it. Bill, what I wanted to tell you is that there is, I saw on the EDUCAUSE site, blogs and wikis, and there isn't one yet for project management. And so I think it would be a great idea if, to start that and to have some conversation. I know there's that listserv, but I did see that it said a wiki, there's a spot available.
Yeah,
so I would like to set that up and keep this ongoing, the communication. But I'd be very interested in hearing what you have to say.
Thank you.
Okay.
This EDUCAUSE 2008 Annual Conference Podcast is sponsored by Real Networks. Outsourced hosting of multi-format digital media content is available from Real's own CDN, the Real Broadcast Network. Information at rbn.com.